Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I love that new intro. Isn't it great? And Jeremy, the audio genius who came up with all that, he said he's going to make a bunch more. Well, he's going to make a few more. And then as we come up with more sound bites and more beats to use and whatever, we'll figure out. We'll just make more and more of them. Apparently, he likes making them. Isn't that cool? I got some good old sound bites I've acquired over the years. And now that I have another, I don't usually have much of an opportunity to play them on the show, really, but sometimes. But now that I have a good reason again, I'm going to really be keeping my ear out for good audio. I got a good clip this morning of, well, I don't want to ruin it for you. You'll hear it someday. Turn my mic up here a little bit. That way I can mumble and you can still hear me. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is the website. I'm not really an org, but some other guy's got .com. ScottHorton.org. And, it's my show. Gonna have a good show today. Got three good interviews lined up. The brilliant Jim Loeb will be here to talk about the very intricate ins and outs of the politics surrounding the Iran nuclear deal. I woke up this morning thinking, if only I knew what Jim Loeb knew about everything. So Jim Loeb's going to be on the show. Charles Goyette is also going to be here. My very good friend Charles Goyette is going to be on the show. He's got a new project that he's going to tell you about. Yeah, it's something you could help with, but I think you're going to want to help with it. The great Charles Goyette, he'll be back on the show. And Michael Alexander Gould Wartofsky. Michael Alexander Gould Wartofsky is going to be on the show, and he's going to be talking about America's fascist totalitarian police state. George Orwell never could have predicted about the microchips and the flash drives and just how much computing power there can be. He did have cameras everywhere in 1984. Cameras everywhere. Microphones, too, even out in the woods. But he couldn't have anticipated that you could have the computers take the place of all the manpower spying on everybody in the way that our government does it now. And then again, 1984 was 31 years ago, so, right? Yeah. So, yeah, now it's 2015, and boy, oh boy. And in fact, so let's talk about police state stuff that is not going to fit into that interview. And I'm sorry, I don't know. There's ISIS, there's Palestine, there's the Iran. Well, there's a lot of things to choose from. Let me try to get some police state news out of the way here in this first segment here. First of all, a federal court overruled its own self. The 11th Circuit Court of Appeals overturned a three-judge panel of its own, of the same court. I don't know exactly how that works. Anyway, and they ruled that investigators, this is a federal circuit court of appeals, ruled that the feds do not need a search warrant to obtain cell phone tower location records in criminal prosecutions. In other words, there's no exclusionary rule. They won't be thrown out. They can be used. And so there's no reason for the government to bother trying to get a warrant. And, I don't know. I really should have Marcy on to explain exactly what all this means. But what it means is that you're not free. You understand the premise that these courts were coming from was, well, the government can do whatever they feel like, right? Unless you can come up with some overwhelming reason why not, and so, screw you. That's what the Constitution says. We the people create a government and say that it can do whatever it wants. Go ahead, guys. That's what it says. It's right there in Article 1. Go ahead, guys. Do whatever you want with us. You created us. Our lives are your property. Go right ahead. Right there in Article 2. Article 1. Article 3. Sorry, it says same thing in all three major first three articles there. Anyway, so there you go. You're less free. And then in this one, I love this, man. You got to love this just for how hated it is. From the AP, officer charged in gray death contends arrest was legal is the headline. And then the whole article is how legal was Freddie Gray's knife. He had a knife in his pocket, right? He didn't attack anyone with it. He certainly didn't attack a cop with it. And what it comes down to is, was his pocket knife a, well, nobody says really it was a switchblade. The question is, what sort of pseudo switchblade was it? It's a spring-assisted locking pocket knife. And so, an automatic knife, this is, I love this, an automatic knife, the criminal, illegal kind, means all you do is push a button and the blade pops out, the expert quoted here said. A lot of knives will have a little spring assist, so when you push it open with your thumb, the knife will open up pretty much by itself. This is the law. And so, this is their excuse of whether they're going to get away with his arrest or not, was, well, you know, it was not a switchblade, it was just a spring assist, but it was very springy. And I think it may have been springy enough to be past the too springy threshold for whether it was illegal for this now murdered dead man to have it in his pocket. Because, see, Americans aren't free. You don't have the right to carry a knife. Let me put it a better way. The state of Maryland has all the authority in the world to decide which pocket knife you may have and which pocket knife they can murder you for having. Make sure to think about this case specifically the next time you're at the ball game and everybody's singing their gospel hymn to the state. And everyone's taking off their baseball cap and putting it over their heart and praying to Washington, D.C. This is what government is. The people who decide what kind of knife you may possess. You don't decide that. They decide that. And then after they murder you, then they'll quibble over whether your pocket knife was too springy. And I know what you're thinking. Well, I just better make sure my pocket knife doesn't have a spring. Right. That's because you are not free. You better make sure that your spring, at least if you got a spring, buddy, it better not be too springy or else they'll get away with murdering you, which, in fact, it doesn't matter because they'll get away with murdering you anyway. It's the same thing happened here to Eric Harris. The F your breath victim. Oh my God, I'm losing my breath. I'm losing my breath, he said as he died. And the cop said, F your breath. Well, what was his problem? His problem was he was set up in a sting operation to sell a 9mm. Tell me, right-wing conservative law and order types, is it a crime for a man to own a 9mm? Does it really matter, like Tawny said in Dred Scott, whether his skin color is black or not, whether he has the right to own a gun or not? You realize that's in Dred Scott, the most infamous of all U.S. Supreme Court decisions ever? The one that said that a black man has no rights that a white man is bound to respect? Because he said, just think about it for a minute. Little thought experiment, everyone, if you will. If a black man is a man and has, you know, rights like the rest of us human beings, then that would mean that they have the right to bear arms. And I know you're not saying they have the right to bear arms. That's in there. That's in Dred Scott. Read it with your own eyes. So this guy, Eric Harris, that died, he was set up in a gun control scheme, entrapment plot. And, oh man, I'm glad I didn't have time to get to this one. Jesus. We'll be right back in just a sec. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betray their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy. The Off-Now project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, guys. Welcome back. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. Like I say, Jim Loeb's coming up, then Charles Goyette and Michael Alexander Gould Wartofsky. He's got four names. That's what a great writer he is. Yesterday, I was sort of interviewed, sort of guest host, co-host type thing on the Libertarian Angle with Bumper Hornberger. So check that out at fff.org. You can look at my beard and my office. FFF.org, the Libertarian Angle, Iraq, and other foreign policy disasters. And, yeah, so there's that. And I'm going to be on the Tom Woods Show today, which I guess means tomorrow. I think they're delayed by a day. But Tom Woods is going to interview me about, you know, the wars and things today on his show. And, yeah, so that should be cool, too, you know. Good old Tom. By the way, people have asked me about the book. I wish he hadn't said anything until we had something going. But we had a deal. We're going to write a book. And then Tom decided, you know, I think I've got about 10 obligations too many here. I don't know how the hell I'm going to do this. I think I got to call it off. And I says, hey, I understand, dude. You have a whole Catholic family full of kids there, and I don't know how you could possibly keep up with them. I can't even keep up with how many there are, you know? I don't know. You know, go ahead. Take care of what you got to take care of. So, but then he said, you know, I got less obligations. I think I want to do the book some more again. So I said, all right, let's do the book. And then he said, I'll get back to you. So I wrote up a proposal. Didn't take me but a minute. To write up a proposal, and I think we're going to move on that here at some point, and then, you know, maybe I can find a way to carve out the time. I guess I'll have to get some kind of clockwork orange device to keep my eyes open, and I'll just read and write all night, and then do this all day, and I just won't sleep. That'll be my solution. I'll be like a prisoner at Guantanamo on the frequent flyer program. Anyway, so, yeah, back to the police state. I understand that liberals, like conservatives, really don't enjoy thinking things through. So they think things like, man, I don't like guns, and I wish we didn't have so many guns in our society and so many people get murdered all the time, and so I support gun control. And they kind of figure that somebody else has thought it through for them or something. But, yeah, no, nobody on that side has really thought it through. Because, see, there's about 310, 320, whatever, 100 million Americans, and there's about 400, 500 million firearms in the hands of about half of us. And there's no way to make that stop being the deal other than having a bunch of cops armed to the teeth with guns go out and get them. And never mind the red herring of mass gun confiscation, which I don't think there's a politician brave enough to try that. But what, you know, gun control in practice means the state picking on guess who? All of liberals' favorite, you know, protected classes of people. People who usually don't have the kind of connections to get away with gun possession crimes. Now, a rich white guy from the rich white part of town can get in a hell of a lot of trouble for having a gun he's not supposed to have, too. I ain't saying that, but you think that's who the cops usually target? Nah. Because they might know somebody who knows somebody and be able to, you know, get out of it. But poor black people, eh. You can arrest them on possession charges all day long. And it's just, you know, tax farming. That's all it is. The east side or the west side or whichever side it is in your town is the side of town where those people are there just for the cops. I mean, I guess they don't pay income taxes because they don't make enough. So the cops just fine them and fee them and figure out ways to oppress them in every way that they can. And then sometimes when they murder a guy, they try to make the case that, yeah, he had a pocket knife. Think about that, that's their excuse for killing Freddie Gray. That he had a pocket knife. Not that he did anything to anyone with it. Just that he had it. A pocket knife. And then with Eric Harris, they were entrapping him on a gun charge. Now show me the Law and Order right-winger who thinks it's a crime for a man to have a 9mm gun. Isn't it your damn Democrat neighbor you can't stand who says that you ought to have 15 pieces of paperwork and have to be a gun store to sell a gun to another gun owner or would-be gun owner? And can't liberals and conservatives see the economics in each other's wars, the war on guns and the war on crime and the war on drugs? That all you do is you don't abolish guns, you don't abolish drugs, you just criminalize entire classes of people who possess them. That's all you do. Drive up the prices, turn the market over to black market criminal dealers who then use violent force to create cartels. It's less like that with guns, I guess, because guns are mostly legal, but still there are black markets in guns too. And anyway, don't you remember the Branch Davidians? They hadn't done anything to anybody either. They were wanted. The bogus warrant was on the false assertion that they owed a $200 tax to the ATF for buying semi-automatic SKS rifles, I believe it was, which is, you know, the knockoff AK-47. Semi-automatic. Pay your taxes, Branch Davidians, or die. That's gun control in real life. F your breath. Just lay down. I'm sorry, I can't say it. I'd like to do basic journalism here. I guess I can technically say it on LRN, but you know what it is. And think about that. That's the last thing this guy hears as he's dying, as he's got another cop's knee in the back of his head, smashing his face into the pavement, into the asphalt. The other one's just mocking him and yelling at him for daring to run when they entrapped him on a gun, you know, sale. Sick, man. And, Omar Khadr is out? Is he out? Oh, no, they're appealing. The government is appealing his bail, of course. Because I read a thing that said they're going to let him out, but with an ankle bracelet. So, sorry, I guess the story I have there is not the latest. Or maybe they're going to let him out on an ankle bracelet while the government appeals. Anyway, I'm not going to tell you the whole story of Omar Khadr, but look it up, man. You'll be like, what? That doesn't seem right to me. I don't know. And then check this out. Not only can cops murder you and get away with it all day long, but their kids have sovereign immunity, too. There's this guy, Ty Sawyer, from Delaware, was in a fight and was beaten to death after he was already on the ground, allegedly. This guy, Patrick Downey, kicked him in the head. And it killed him. And the cops aren't even investigating it as a crime. The cops are taking the son of the cops' word for it that, hey, he agreed to fight me. No harm, no foul. He's dead. And it was a cop's son who did it. So sovereign immunity, free to go. That's called the rule of law in America. You like that? Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our first guest today is the great Jim Loeb, Washington editor of Interpress Service and keeper of the Loeb Log. That's spelled like your earlobe there, loeblog.com. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Jim?
I'm okay. How are you? Everything okay, Scott?
Oh, yeah, there you go. Your audio sounded bad for a second, but now it's all right. I don't know. I think that might be my equipment, not yours. Anyway, we'll try it out. Your pal and mine, Ali Gharib, has an article here at your site, loblog.com. And, of course, you're just as good on all this stuff as him. And he was unavailable. But anyway, this is the subject matter I'd like to cover, at least for starters here. And that is the politics, particularly in the U.S. Senate, on the Corker bill to give the Congress oversight, an up or down vote, I guess, on the Iran nuclear deal after the deal is struck, you know, presuming that it is struck, and all the mess going on with the so-called poison pill amendments, if indeed that's what they are, and what's behind that, and the split between the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee and some of the more prominent neoconservative writers and all of that. So dive right in and tell us what you think is important here.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think the legislative situation is kind of fluid at the moment. The majority leader, Mitch McConnell, said that he wanted to wrap up a vote on the Corker bill, the Corker-Cardin bill, by tomorrow. So I assume now that he's spoken, that's what will happen, and there won't be any additional controversial amendments. So the bill will pass. Then it has to be taken up by the House, and I don't know how quickly Boehner wants to take it up. I'm just not clear about that at all. I think there has been some talk within the Republican caucus about a couple of alternatives. One is to indeed force a vote on a final agreement, presuming one is reached by the end of June or shortly thereafter, either in July or September, and to force the Democrats to vote to not to disapprove of the deal, which the Republicans think will be a winner for them. But there's also the possibility that there'll be an effort to put some of the more radical amendments, like requiring Iran to recognize Israel, onto unrelated legislation like the Pentagon Authorization Act, which is coming up next month. Mm-hmm. And so I guess there's quite a lot of debate about what the Republicans are going to do. But to go back to the original question and what Ali was writing about on the blog, essentially there's been something of a split, at least in tactics, between AIPAC on the one hand and more radical forces led by Bill Kristol at the Weekly Standard, who he's also the director of the Emergency Committee for Israel, and within Congress by Tom Cotton, the Arkansas senator, as well as Marco Rubio, it seems that they wanted their so-called poison pill amendments to be voted on, whereas AIPAC, the premier kind of Israel lobby, which tries very hard to retain its bipartisan appeal, has taken the position that Corker, Cardin should be passed without any poison pill amendments, because I think they wish to set the stage for a vote of disapproval of any deal. I think that's their goal. So there's a serious tactical disagreement between...
What is Bill Kristol going for? I don't understand why they would... I mean, I understand that they claim that the Corker bill, Corker Cardin, whatever, is not hardcore enough. It doesn't give them... It doesn't require a two-thirds supermajority ratification and this kind of thing. And that kind of deal. But those aren't the amendments, right? The poison pill amendments are just, oh, you have to never give another dollar to Hezbollah, or you have to recognize Israel as a Jewish state, which even the Israelis don't necessarily do in law, right? That's still controversial in Israel, but it's not supposed to be for Iran. And then, but so the only purpose of those amendments could be to force Obama to veto it, right? And then so they could try again and have a harsher terms in the next bill. Is that the point?
Well, I think there are a number of different considerations. I mean, remember, Kristol's not only a kind of Likud activist; he's also a Republican activist. And you know, he comes from neoconservative royalty. You know, whose roots lie in kind of people who were at least flirting with Trotskyism, and they retain that kind of Trotsky element of, you know, if you can't get what you want, you burn it down. There's a kind of all or nothing mentality at work. And I think the idea is, okay, I mean, Kristol originally supported the Corker bill when it was originally introduced, because it had a number of provisions that were very problematic to the administration, and the administration was strongly opposed to it. But when Cardin moved in and began negotiating a compromise with Corker, which eventually was approved by the Foreign Relations Committee unanimously, those more problematic provisions were either eliminated or substantially watered down. And Kristol became increasingly unhappy with Corker and eventually came out strongly against it. And I think he's acting as both a pro-Israel or pro-Likud, more precisely, activist, and as a Republican activist, because he believes that the Iran deal will not be popular, and to the extent that Republicans can show that they oppose an Iran deal, that will benefit them in the 2016 elections. AIPAC, on the other hand, of course, wants to retain its bipartisan kind of stature, and so they welcomed the Cardin
popular,
agreement.
Does he mean popular as in the American public or popular within powerful Republican donors?
Well, he certainly, I think, represents the interests of some of the powerful Republican donors like Sheldon Adelson.
Because, of course, the polls say that even most Republicans are the worst poll I saw on this was that a plurality of Republicans support the bill, and in other cases it's an outright majority. Or not the bill, but I mean the nuclear deal itself.
Well, I mean, I think he thinks that there are enough holes to be poked in the deal that they can bring around Republican voters. But he does also, as you suggest, kind of represent the interests of some wealthy Republican donors who are going to play a major role in determining who the presidential candidate is going to be for the Republican Party in 2016. Now, I mean, what's interesting, I think the most interesting thing, and what Ali noted in his post, was that the Wall Street Journal editorial board, which is about as hardline neoconservative as you can find, implicitly criticized Crystal's position and ultimately backed AIPAC.
All right, now hold it right there, Jim. We got to take this break. But when we get back, we'll talk about that, the splits within the neocons, and there are various editorial pages here over the tactics that they're employing against the Iran deal, particularly in the Senate, with the great Jim Loeb at loeblog.com. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with the great Jim Loeb from Interpress Service and loeblog.com. We're talking about, you know, politics of the Iran deal here. Ali Gharib has a new one there, Neocon versus Neocon on Iran. And that's where we left off was we got Jen Rubin in the Washington Post. We've got, I guess, just the Wall Street Journal in the Wall Street Journal. I don't know if it was an unsigned editorial. And then you got Bill Kristol, of course, at the Weekly Standard. And then you got his protege, as Ali Gharib calls him, Tom Cotton, and suck up Marco Rubio in the Senate, following Kristol's lead. And so where we left off at the break, you said the Wall Street Journal, in a kind of understated way, but they pretty much went out after Bill Kristol for pushing these poison pill amendments against the Corker deal.
And as did Jen Rubin of the Washington Post, which was also a surprise, because these are very hardline neoconservative, well, in the case of the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal institution, and then Rubin herself is quite shrill in her own, I think, extremism. But yeah, they both criticized, at least implicitly, Kristol and Cotton. But again, I think this is mainly a tactical disagreement. They're saying that, you know, don't let the to Bill, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. We can still use Corker Cardin in order to, at the very least, embarrass Democrats and perhaps even derail the deal or sabotage a deal through congressional action. Although the Wall Street Journal's editorial was particularly interesting because it seemed to be reconciled to a deal being reached, number one, and number two, Congress really being unable to do anything about it until the successor to Obama takes office in January 2017. They're looking much further ahead. They seem to think that a deal at this point is inevitable, and they'd like to be able to derail it whenever it is that Obama leaves office.
Yeah, that's interesting that that's their take on it, is that once they get the deal signed under this bill, under the Cardin bill, assuming it passes both houses and is signed by the president, that even though they have the authority to vote it down, they won't be able to. Now, you think that's really right?
Well, I mean, I think barring any unexpected event or any kind of provocation by either hardliners in Iran or Saudi Arabia or Israel that would involve any kind of military action on the part of Iran and in some way then oblige the United States to do something. Barring that scenario, I don't think the votes are going to be there to reject a deal. I think a veto, the Republican quest for a veto-proof majority is at this point considered quixotic, at least by the Wall Street Journal. And it may even be that they won't be able to get enough votes to prevent a Democratic filibuster against any resolution to disapprove the deal. I think they're hoping that they can get disapproval of the deal and force a veto, but they may not have enough votes.
Well, and it seems like once they announce, we got a deal, and the entire United Nations permanent membership of the Security Council are behind it, and look at all the signatures on it, and we're moving forward now, then it's got to be the case that, again, all things being equal, as you said, no Jundala attacks inside Iran or anything over the weekend, or not the weekend, but you know what I mean, over the time between the end of June, here and the end of June, then at that point, then the political winds will have really shifted toward the president, and they would really be, it would really be bad politics at that point probably for them to spoil the deal after it's already signed, right?
I mean, that's what I think. I think it'll be even very difficult for a Republican president to back out of a deal unless there's some kind of flagrant violation of the agreement that takes place, you know, that a secret enrichment facility is discovered or something along those lines. But frankly, I mean, even Benjamin Netanyahu has told his security cabinet that his worst fear is that Iran will be scrupulous in abiding by any deal for the life of that deal.
Right.
And therefore, there will be no way to overturn it at all or overturn Iran's accumulating expertise on nuclear power and how you use nuclear energy.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one thing that's interesting about all this is, I mean, and I'm generalizing, obviously, but there's value in it. It seems to me like this nuclear deal actually doesn't change anything. They're going from a safeguarded civilian nuclear program to a very, very safeguarded nuclear program, civilian electricity program here. And, I mean, obviously they've made some major concessions, but they haven't changed the nature of their program at all because it never was really about making weapons in the first place. Although maybe a little bit of research had been done here or there, but I think even most of that has been debunked by your Gareth Porter, among others. And so it really doesn't make much difference because all the war party hype about Iran and their nuclear program has basically been just a bunch of hype all along. So there's no reason for them to change. Even as this Politico article put it, the GOP is not arguing science on Iran. They got some slogans, but they don't want to argue about what percent uranium-235 it takes to make a bomb because they'll lose that argument. Or, you know, about the details of the safeguards agreement, they'd lose that argument. And so all they've got is a bunch of hype, and all we've got is a civilian nuclear program. So I don't see really what's the big deal, kind of, either way, for reality or for their continued narrative that Iran is a threat. So what's really their problem with this thing anyway? You know? I mean, like,
well,
one more, just to try to make myself clear because I'm not very eloquent sometimes. Like that story you just were referring to where Netanyahu said his fear is that if this deal takes place and the Iranians live up to it, that they'll be able to normalize relations with the world and with the West and that kind of thing. But I don't see that in the cards at all, right? Do you?
No, I mean, I don't think the Israelis are fearful of a nuclear attack by Iran on Israel. I think what they're fearful of is a major change in the balance of power in the Middle East. And I think personally that it's indisputable that if a deal is reached and sanctions are lifted, Iran is going to become a much bigger player than it is now. I don't think it can achieve hegemony over the region by any means because there are just too many states that are against it and that will oppose hegemony and are able to do that. But it'll become a much bigger factor than it has been. And to the extent that the West in general and the U.S. in particular can achieve any kind of rapprochement with Iran, people's power calculations in the region will change. Certainly, Saudi Arabia has quite a lot to lose in terms of its influence. And I think Israel fears that it also will lose. And, you know, at the same time, I mean, Iran already has considerable influence through, for example, the Syrian regime and through Hezbollah on Israel's border. And Israel and Saudi Arabia both would have to adjust quite substantially to this changed situation. And I think both being essentially status quo powers, they find that very difficult a very difficult prospect for them. And I particularly, again, to the extent that Iran defines itself as being opposed to Israel and being opposed to the kind of Sunni supremacy that Saudi Arabia has become increasingly aggressive about, there could be a lot of trouble for those two countries. I mean, it's not a pleasant prospect if you're used to a certain situation where a very, very, well, a hyperpower like the United States is essentially backing you virtually without condition for a period of more than 30 years, and suddenly you have someone in your neighborhood who the United States is taking much more seriously as a possible partner in various respects at your expense. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's perceived also by those powers as a zero-sum game. So any gain by Iran is a loss to them. And I think that's a lot of what is motivating this. On the Republican side, since you raised that question, I think, because you have the importance of political donors like Sheldon Adelson, like Paul Singer, on which, you know, Republican presidential candidates will necessarily depend, they feel obliged to take strongly anti-Iranian positions, and you can see that virtually every day that the candidates are kind of competing with each other for Adelson's help and support, and that also I think is contributing to the kind of political movements or maneuvers that we're seeing. And I think that partially explains at least, you know, why the Republicans are so eager to be seen as attacking the deal.
Right. Well, and you know, it seems like it's still a minor rapprochement at best, and scaremongering against Iran will still continue. It was funny, Gareth had that piece yesterday about how, you know, the missile defense lobby has Iran as their entire excuse. So this is a very powerful lobby. And there are other, you know, many other interests, as you mentioned there, for 30 years, not just Israel and Saudi, but all kinds of interests are used to the status quo there. And then I saw where Obama this morning is saying, oh, no, yeah, no, we definitely still need missile defense in case of Iran ever does go nuclear. So I thought maybe he was reading Gareth and decided he would give a deliberate sop to the missile defense lobby that, don't worry, guys, we'll keep you on the dole if you'll get line up behind the nuclear deal here.
Well, yeah, it may not be the U.S. who's consuming the missile defense. It may be a lucrative market, and undoubtedly is a lucrative market for the GCC countries, including Saudi Arabia. I mean, it's lucrative for the defense contractors, yeah, who want to sell to these countries. Yep. So they'll keep hyping the Iran threat, and to a certain extent, even though there may be some rapprochement and some cooperation between the U.S. and Iran on regional issues, I'm sure that the whatever administration is in power here in Washington, they'll still keep talking about the potential threat of Iran because they want to keep Saudi Arabia on their side, And they want, yes, particularly, I think, the goal of the Obama administration is to achieve some kind of equilibrium between Iran and the Sunni powers and Israel in the region so that the United States can begin to move to a more offshore position as a balancer, and at the same time sell a lot of weapons to worried clients.
Yep. Yeah, well, hell, I already kept you over time, so I'll go for one more thing. I had Mark Perry on the show, and it was about Pentagon opposition to the war in Yemen that they're fighting. And that was one of the things that he was saying, was that on the bright side, there are some weapons contractors who are looking forward to selling to Iran itself rather than just selling to the Saudis against. They can sell to both sides again. It's been since the 70s, since Lockheed got to equip them with fighter jets and that kind of stuff, right? So.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I mean, and it was taken here, the Russian announcement that they would indeed go ahead with the sale of these pretty advanced air defense systems to Iran, which they first promised like more than a decade ago, is a bid by Russia to make a claim to the anticipated arms market that Iran will represent. I mean, we're really going back in kind of in time to perhaps defeating a lot of weapons to the entire region and making a lot of money that way.
All right. Well, with that, I will let you go. Thank you so much for coming back on the show, Jim.
Yeah, not at all. It was a pleasure.
Great to talk to you. That's the great Jim Loeb, everybody. He's at loeblog.com, Washington Bureau Chief for Interpress Service, ipsnews.net. This one is by Ali Gharib, Neocon versus Neocon on Iran, and Charles Goyette is next. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code SCOTT when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. If you heard a little bit of laughter in my voice there, it wasn't from the onion thing. It was because I was thinking of when I was younger, driving a cab around, I would pass out copies of Ron Paul speeches from the House of Representatives, you know, printed out. And I would tell the people in my cab, look, check it out. I know, you think I'm crazy. I probably am. I'd tell the people in my cab, check it out. There's one good congressman. No, I know. You would never believe that there's one good congressman. But actually, there's one good congressman. And here's his great speech that he gave. Here, read this. And that was because I didn't have a radio show at the time. I wished I had one. Anyway, I've been loving Ron Paul since 1997. And you know who also loves Ron Paul? It's Charles Goyette, our good friend, formerly the most independent talk show host in America, and author of The Dollar Meltdown and Red, Blue, and Broke All Over. And my good buddy, he's at charlesgoyette.com. Welcome back to the show, Charles. How you doing?
Scott's always great to talk to you. I'm doing great.
So you love Ron Paul, do you?
Hey, you know, he needs to, the name Ron Paul, you know, I get a lot of this, you probably do too. Somebody said, oh, you're doing something with Rand Paul. Is that? I go, no, Ron Paul. And so I don't want the Ron Paul's accomplishments to kind of get diluted and confused with some of the other stuff that's going on in politics. And now that he's no longer, you know, in Washington, I think it's a good time to kind of chisel into stone what Ron Paul's accomplishments have been and the motion that he gave to the freedom movement in this country.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, so when I'm going back to the early 2000s talking about him, he was basically the best kept secret of every libertarian in America. It was like there are two or three libertarians in every neighborhood, and they all loved him, but nobody else had ever heard of him, right? So it's like, oh, wow, check it out on C-SPAN. Ron Paul's talking. Everybody shut up. It's Ron Paul. But he was this kind of, I don't want to say a fringe figure, because he's not fringe, really, but it's just the amount of exposure that he ever got. And then what happened was he ran for president, and that changed everything.
those were pretty heady days in 2007 when he became a presidential candidate. It was galvanizing times, wasn't it? I mean, what about the moment when Rudy Giuliani, the long-since-forgotten former mayor boy of New York, tried to call him out in one of those presidential debates, and Ron said, I demand you retract that. And Ron leaned in, and he raised his finger, and he said, no. And people across America are going, wait a minute. Hold the phone. Hold the corn. There's somebody different in here. That's never been allowed in a presidential debate before. So those were pretty exciting times, and he awakened a lot of people. And a lot of them were, you know, students and young people at the time. You think about that, 2008, that was 7 years ago. These are people starting to move into positions of, you know, more influence and impact in the world around them. And it remains to be seen yet what impact the Ron Paul revolution will ultimately have, but it will certainly have one on the national conversation in this country.
Yep. And now, so he's my favorite legislator in all of world history, and it's not because he did a lot of reforming and this and that while he was in there, because, as he's explained before, he'd have had to trade those votes for a lot of other votes, and he's not really, never was in a position to do that. So, as a critic once wrote to the Houston Chronicle, he always just went to Washington, D.C. to write articles, give speeches, and vote no, and just try to set an example as best he could. And then when he ran for president, you know, I think we all kind of knew that it would have taken, well, it would have taken an honest media, you know, willing to give him a fair shake as much as they're willing to give Michelle Bachmann or any of these other kooks who they're more than fair to. And it would have taken maybe much more than that for him to really have had a shot at the nomination and the presidency running in a Republican Party and in a country where he could have probably got the raw numbers of people to support him, but how to get them all into the Republican Party in time for the primaries and the caucuses and in an organized way, that's kind of a different issue. I don't know how possible that ever was, but it doesn't matter because ultimately, either way, it was the greatest speaking tour on behalf of the Enlightenment principles that this nation was founded on, in part.
Well,
happened. I mean,
you've got two issues going there, really. You've got, and these both play a part in Empire of Lies, the documentary that I'm going to do about Ron Paul.
I was going to ask
Empire
you about that in a minute.
Yeah, but you know, they both play a part because, first of all, I want to take dead aim at the lapdog press that you identified, you know, who tried to bury the news of the Ron Paul revolution. In the course of doing some preparatory work, I look back at an interview that Ron Paul did with Bill O'Reilly in 2007. And it's very plain to see. I mean, we have the benefit of plenty of hindsight, you know, besides being, you know, informed by some wisdom from the libertarian perspective and the historical precedents. We now have 8 years benefit of hindsight. And you watch this interview. It's available on YouTube. Virtually everything Bill O'Reilly said was wrong, wrong, wrong. And everything that Ron Paul said was right, right, right. And you look at this, and still O'Reilly's making, you know, $30 million a year or whatever, and still bloviating from the lead chair on cable television, despite the fact that he's been wrong, wrong, wrong about everything. But, you know, the whole lapdog, the whole statist media, you know, is just should be the shame of the American people. And it is particularly, it's very visible. It plays out large in the story of Ron Paul's candidacy. You get guys like Bob Schieffer at CBS News, disdain with which, you know, these people would treat Ron Paul for daring to question the governing classes and the Washington consensus. And so there was Bob Schieffer, and, you know, he could barely constrain his contempt for Ron when Ron would, you know, challenge something that we all know now in hindsight what he was right about. But, oh, Bob Schieffer would visibly swoon, you know, when George W. Bush appeared on the deck of an aircraft carrier in a flight suit. Oh, and he helped propagate the lies about weapons of mass destruction. So these guys are wrong, wrong, wrong. But the contempt, I'm going to show it. I'm going to, maybe I won't even play his comments. I'll just show the disdain, the hateful, disgusting look on Bob Schieffer's face when Ron Paul refuses to go along with the Washington consensus on Meet the Press. It is a sight to behold, Scott.
Yeah, no, I remember that one well. Bob Schieffer, I think, was at least as bad as the very worst of them. But back to the greatest speaking tours on behalf of liberty in, and as you mentioned, real history, sound economics, that ever happened ever. And how much things changed. Like I said before, nobody ever heard of this guy before. And then in hearing of this guy, they heard of libertarianism and not some kind of wishy-washy Cato-y libertarianism, but we demand the abolition of the central bank and the empire libertarianism, you know, right for exactly what the people were wanting to hear. It's like you mentioned with the Giuliani thing. The reason people were so shocked is because they know that no politician on that level would ever tell the truth about what the government is really doing with us. And here, and he's this kind old grandfatherly sort of a guy, and he's perfectly happy to tell you exactly what he thinks you need to know, regardless of your feelings, but only because he loves you, you know, only because he's trying to help. And people just latched right onto that. I know I can trust this guy. Here's a guy who clearly is not a liar, unlike the rest of them.
And then Giuliani says, "Well, I never heard such a thing in all my days." And so then Ron has a press conference the next day or two, and he says, "Here's some reading that his Giulianiness might want to actually consider, so that he could be informed, and maybe he ought to read Chalmers Johnson and." You know, maybe he ought to read Michael Scheuer, and maybe he ought to figure out, what drives suicide bombers. And here's an academic book from a University of Chicago professor that's actually looked into the matter. Maybe he ought to do a little reading and become informed. Oh, it was wonderful, Scott. It was a great time to give these guys their comeuppance and to see people kind of flock to the banner of a truth teller for a change.
Yeah, and then, you know, this is kind of a problem for liberals. Some of them figured it out, but others really knee-jerked that, you know, how dare this, right-wing Republican congressman from Texas be better on all this stuff than all of them. And so, hey, as long as Barry's doing the bombing, it ain't too bad, right, guys?
Yeah.
Anyway, we got to take this break. We'll be right back with the great Charles Goyette, talk all about his brand-new project. I'll spoil it. No, I won't. Hang tight, guys. Just a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, so you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm me. This is my show. On the line, I got my good friend Charles Goyette. So we're talking about how much we love Ron Paul and how grateful we are for his awesome campaigns for the presidency and all the libertarianism that he spread and the evil of the media overlords who successfully, to a degree, froze them out and all the rest of that. But so, Charles, tell me, what are you doing about it?
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to do a documentary about Ron Paul, and it's not a biography. It's not about who his playmates were as a kid or, you know, where he met his wife or anything. I'm sure those things are all interesting to people, but I'm going to do a documentary about Ron Paul that actually deals with the nature of the state. And, in fact, it's called Empire of Lies from that great quote of Ron Paul's that'll make it in all the quotation books, that truth is treason in the empire of lies. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to do a documentary. The target date for release is sometime during the primaries when people are paying a lot of attention to politics this time next year. And to do it, to fund it, I thought, Scott, it was absolutely important to keep this thing independent. And so I turned to the Ron Paul supporters, the libertarians, the grassroots freedom movement in America. I've got plenty of years of experience in the media business in corporate America. And in deciding to do a Ron Paul biographical documentary, I knew the one thing I didn't want to do is go to corporate funding go to the big media institutions, because with that you lose control of the story, and I didn't want to make, you know, their weak or watered down story. So I've started a Kickstarter campaign to fund the documentary, and the documentary is called Empire of Lies, and you can find it online. If you go to Kickstarter Empire of Lies, you can find it right there. And so that's what I'm doing, and we've had great people in the freedom movement supporting this effort. Dr. Paul, in fact, is has agreed to a private dinner with the top contributors to this effort. I mean, the, you know, people that are really writing a check to the documentary project. So I have a private dinner with him, limited to a very small number of people, to 20 leading contributors, because it'll give people a chance to actually talk to him and interact with him instead of going to some big, you know, dinner somewhere. We've got people that have given books. Tom Woods is sending autographed copies of his book. Lou Rockwell's autographed copies of his last book. David Stockman said, how many do you want? And I said, well, maybe 5 or 10. He said, I'll send you 20. Do this documentary, he said. So I've got a lot of people have contributed things just as kind of thank yous, sort of rewards for participating in the funding of a documentary, and we're just bursting at the seams to start principal photography. We have to finish the fundraising here over the course of the next month.
All right, now hang on. I want to play this clip real quick.
Until now.
I've had a lot of other groups doing this, but there was some reluctance, either my position or the individual's ability to understand the philosophy. And that's where I felt comfortable, because I've known you now for couple years and way back in radio times, and I've read your books, and in these last 2 years we've gotten to know each other very well, and we've done a lot of work on podcasts as radio as well as radio ads, not 5 or 10 but into the hundreds. So we have spent a lot of time on this. So the one thing that I know with certainty is you know the philosophy,
the media.
All right, so yeah, the media. Yeah, no, the philosophy. So that was Ron Paul telling Charles, this is why I chose you to do the documentary.
Yeah, and he's, it's funny how, you know, he's been approached over the years many, many times by all kinds of people to do a story like this. People think it's, you know, it's commercially attractive, and it is. But, you know, not all of them are really driven by spreading the message of liberty. And that's clearly my interest, as it is his. So, yeah, I'm really honored that he's agreed to participate in this with me.
Yeah, well, and now, so here's the thing. Back to the point is, the reason that Ron Paul is so important isn't because, you know, us libertarians, we're some wacky little sect, and this guy agrees with us on everything. So, hey, let's have a barbecue or whatever. The point is that he's right on all the most important things in the world, which are all of the worst things that our government is doing, torturing people and murdering people and starting wars and backing their enemies and fighting their friends and acting like madmen all the damn time. And like we were talking about before, what's so great about this guy is somehow he is in the House of Representatives. Maybe it has something to do with the fact that he delivered about a third of the residents of his precinct as a OBGYN. So he had this safe district. And he was able to get up there and just tell the damn truth that no one else will say about this empire lies, as you put it, the most important issues of our time.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing that he did. And, you know, it's I suppose one of my great joys in producing this is to be able to contrast what he said versus the authorities, versus the governing classes, versus the Washington consensus. So, you know, there you get, you know, there you have oh, I don't know, you got Ben Bernanke saying, well, the housing market, no, American housing market's never gone down, it's never going to go down, you know, just as it was teetering on the brink. And then when it fell, he said, well, we've stopped the plunge, you know, the hemorrhaging is over, and it was just getting going. And then you had, you know, Alan Greenspan going, well, I didn't see it coming, and nobody saw it coming. Well, of course people saw it coming. The Austrian school economists saw it coming. Ron Paul not only saw it coming, but he wrote about it, and so I'm providing, you know, the video clips of him on the floor of the House talking about, here's what's going to happen to American housing, and here is why, and here's the pretend solution that they will trot out. But, you know, it's not just about that. I mean, it's issue after issue after issue. You know, it's Ron Paul standing alone in Washington versus the Washington consensus, and over and over and over again, the authorities, the empowered ones, the chosen ones are proven wrong, and Ron Paul is proven right, and he's going to go down as a pivotal historical figure.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, let me know if you ever need a hand finding these clips, because I know they exist of Ron talking specifically about the bubble in housing in the 90s, in the late 90s, and perhaps I think even before the dot-com bubble broke, in the context of, and then once the dot-com bubble breaks, then we're going to see an increase in what we already have as a housing bubble. And I know this is right, Charles, because it's the only explanation for the fact that I was good on this stuff back then at the turn of the millennium. That not only is the dot-com thing a giant fake bubble, and also, yes, I read J. Edward Griffin, and that helped because there's a lot of Mises in there, but it was mostly because of Ron Paul and his speeches that housing is a bubble too. And you know, I remember giving that advice to people who were buying houses, that you should wait till the bubble breaks and they go down. I didn't realize it was going to take 8 years, I guess. Go ahead. They were more or less at the bottom of the bubble at that point compared to how bad it got. But anyway, you know, I know that just because I was, that was how I knew that. I was reading the Ron Paul, you know, weekly essay that he put out. I would play his recorded message that he would leave on my little pirate radio show. And there he was explaining the boom and the bust and how they switch from market to market, which one they inflate and this and that and all that. And that was back, you know, 15 years ago now. Oh, crap. Music's playing. Hang on. I'm going to turn that down. See, I told you, I always blow the second break. So anyway, yeah, man, that's the whole thing about this is if you find an early clip of Ron Paul being right about something extremely important, keep looking because you'll find an even earlier clip of him maybe being even better than that on it. You know what I mean? Like, I found great clips of him talking about causing terrorism against us in 98, but I found even better ones from 97, that kind of thing.
And then it's so easy to find the governing authorities, the ones that show up on the evening news, the ones that are invited to all the right places and given all the right offices and the high appointments and are set for life at the people's expense. It's very easy to find them to contrast with Ron being wrong about everything.
Yeah, you'll never have a problem with that. You could just get, you know, the interns to help with that and don't worry about it. You know, no special expertise required for that. Just go back through the archives by date and then just plug the tape in and you got it right there. So. Yeah, but anyway, cool. So yeah, man, this is great, and I appreciate the timing of it and all of that, and I do think it's real important. I guess one more thing about that is that, you know, the way the media would have it is, boy, Rand better become more moderate instead of his kooky father and become more appealing to the center and this kind of thing, and of course, that's 100% wrong. I mean, what appeal he has is that he's Ron Paul's son, and the more he defends his father's positions, the more he's right about everything. His father, yeah. His father being outside the consensus, as we've been discussing, is the mark of, it's a mark of how correct he's been all along, and people can examine on the specific issues themselves. But anyway, so he needs to, you know, certainly, maybe, I don't know, be reinforced, I guess, in the idea that, running more like his father instead of less actually would increase improve his fortunes and endear him to people who, you know, the people who supported his father and then some.
There's been nobody like Ron Paul in my lifetime, and I don't expect that there'll be another one like him for a very long time to come.
Yep, that's true. All right, well, listen, so everybody go to charlesgoyette.com. And you can find out all about this. There's a YouTube. I put it out on my Twitter feed. You can look at it. Empire of Lies Kickstarter campaign. Just Google that. Empire of Lies Kickstarter campaign. It is the official Ron Paul approved, as you just heard there, authorized documentary. And it is, again, on the issues, the most important issues, the bubbles, the wars, etc., and all of that. And, you know, from a radical libertarian perspective, and a great piece of campaign year propaganda there. So help support if you can. Please help support. Thank you very much for coming on the show, Charles. Good to talk to you again.
Great to speak with you, Scott. Thank you.
All right. That's the great Charles Goyette. Again, his great books are The Dollar Meltdown and Red, Blue, and Broke All Over, that are both classics. I mean, both. They're seriously really good, worth reading twice kind of material there. And the Empire of Lies Kickstarter campaign. It's there on YouTube and at charlesgoyette.com. And we'll be right back. Holy crap, I better hurry.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more war in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C., but those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel Lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I got to sift through my tabs here. Here we go. The Wars Come Home, a five-step guide to the police repression of protest from Ferguson to Baltimore and beyond. It's at tomdispatch.com and also running under Tom's name, I think today, at antiwar.com. If not today, yesterday or tomorrow or something. Anyway, it's under Tom Englehart's name at antiwar.com. And it's really great. You should read it. Welcome to the show, Michael. How are you doing? Oh, did I say it's by, God, I didn't say, it's by Michael Gould Wartofsky. Welcome to the show, Michael. How are you? Oh man, I am so stupid. I didn't hit the button. Worst intro ever. Sorry, everybody. I suck at this, you know. These production values. Oh, I wish I had that clip queued up. All right, anyway, so now I got it right. Now I got him on. I just forgot to hit the button because I do that. It's Michael Alexander Gould Wartofsky. The piece is The Wars Come Home. It's at tomdispatch.com. And at antiwar.com, under Tom Englehart's name there, at antiwar.com. Welcome to the show, Michael. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on the show.
Good. Very happy to have you here. So, really great article here. You go through and break it down in a very thick listicle format, how we are all losing our rights, and especially the right to dissent and protest and participate in power if we're not on the inside of power, basically, in this country. Criminalizing democracy. The revolution within the forum continues, basically. Anyway, yeah.
That's right.
So why don't you just go ahead and take us through it? It's a very important piece. I hope people look at it. Step one, you say, equate dissidents with domestic terrorists. But come on, that's pretty hyperbolic. That's just maybe some right-wing talk radio doing that, right?
Well, certainly not if you're if you're from Baltimore or Ferguson or any of the other cities that have seen major protests this year and last year. From starting last summer, the Department of Homeland Security's Office of Intelligence and Analysis, as well as its so-called Threat Management Division, have been sending out warnings to law enforcement, basically equating those who were protesting in Ferguson and elsewhere with ISIS or with attempts to recruit people to ISIS. Elsewhere, they say that the prospect of civil unrest also raises the potential for civil disobedience, and so they see this as a threat. In New York City, Bill Bratton, our police commissioner, has gone forth with developing a new special ops unit called the Strategic Response Group, which he said was quote unquote designed for dealing with events like our recent protests. Or incidents like Mumbai or Paris. So there's a kind of equation here going on between what you know law enforcement sees as threats from unarmed peaceful protesters and threats from armed militants around the world. Yeah. And some of those tactics that they've been developing around the world, they've imported back to the United States, as we saw in Chicago during the NATO protests. Mm-hmm. With the sort of black site in Homan Square. So those are some examples.
Well, now let's get into some of those examples in a second, but I want to get back to just the theory about, you know, who these forces are being used against and how, why people are protesting and the point of view of the state, why they would equate that with terrorism is because the way they think of it, right, I guess, if they think of it at all, really, is that if you're going to participate in the democracy in America, you pick your party, you join it, and you go to their convention or something, and that's basically it. And they're looking at, you know, protesting in the streets, which, of course, might come with a broken window or two or whatever it is. Usually not too much worse than that. But they look at that as, my God, it's like a third of a revolution or something, you know, as though they're, you know, they're almost powerless and the Reds are going to come and sack them and overthrow the state. Or so they overplay the danger of that kind of thing. And it's just at the time that people have less and less access to the institutions that they actually could exercise some power through that they have to resort to more protesting, and they're seen, and then the population itself is seen as more and more alien from the state that supposedly represents them. I mean, not that they ever really did, but it just seems like we're on this slippery slope getting worse and worse on the one we've probably been on all along, you know?
That's right. And you know, I think they see active citizens, people who are participating in their democracy in a way that's not prescribed by the elites as enemy combatants, as potential threats to the homelands, right? And I think this is the infrastructure and the architecture of this was put in place in the years after 9/11. Those of us who are part of the anti-war movement know that, but it's really come a long way since then, and that's sort of what I was trying to get into here.
Right. Okay. Now, so get into the examples of what has changed in the recent times.
So for one thing, the sheer scope of the resources that are being directed towards the repression of protest, it's really staggering. The 1033 program is one example where the Pentagon has been sending weaponry, military-grade weaponry, and other controlled property, as they call it, to local law enforcement. And that doesn't have to be used for counterterrorism, you know, even if they admit that there's no terrorism involved, they can use it against peaceful protests. DHS, for example, has another program called the Homeland Security Grant Program. They funnel over $1 billion a year to local law enforcement. That provides everything from these Bearcats that we see in the streets of Baltimore, military counterattack vehicles, as they're known, to battle dress and body armor and you know, all the things that we're seeing in these streets. The Department of Justice has another program. So it's really a vast, sort of channel, tunnel for these resources to be funneled into the repression of peaceful protests at the local level, as well as, you know, if it ever rose to the level of national unrest, I'm sure they have a few other tricks up their sleeve. So those are some examples of you know, just some of the resources that have
been. By the way, on that program, did you hear about what happened in Montana a couple of weeks ago where they voted to, you know, basically disassociate from the 1033 and the Homeland Security program there?
That's right. That's right. I think this is a point of unity for a lot of people on the left and the right are seeing this as something that needs to be stopped before it goes any further. So Montana is a great example of that.
Mm-hmm. And that's a great one for liberals and libertarians to argue, you know, and outflank the right on the right and say, hey, man, real law and order people respect the Constitution before the Homeland Security Department, buddy, and that kind of thing. Right. And get them where it hurts. And the George Washington.
That's right. And also those who see that, you know, the kind of law and order that they claim to be enforcing is really not good for either law or order.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So sorry to interrupt there, but I just want to point out that seems like a pretty important victory, especially coming from a conservative state.
Absolutely. Kind of, yep. Absolutely.
Right. And so now you make a very important point here about less than lethal weapons and their use and their increased use and that kind of thing. I bet you could wrap it up in about a minute and a half.
Absolutely. So we're looking at everything from the kind of classic less lethal weapons, that is weapons that are designed to incapacitate their targets, from you know, the classic sort of rubber bullets and tear gas to the new generation of less lethal technologies. There's something called the Bozo bullet. It looks like a clown's nose. You basically put it on your service weapon if you're a police officer or a DHS officer. Turns it into a less lethal gun for as long as you have it on there. You take it off, it's a lethal gun again. But that makes it potentially more likely that you're going to reach for that gun. And we've seen, you know, we've seen people sort of police departments adopting the use of less lethal weapons, but then using them in lethal fashion. So, you know, we've seen people sort of targeted and in some cases shot at, you know, by DHS officer in LA, for example, at a march in Manhattan, and a march in Oakland. People are actually pulling out their handguns. So it's not just less lethal force we're talking about here. It's also the prospect of lethal force.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, like you say, increasing amount of use where maybe they wouldn't have shot you. Now they use a taser. It's supposed to be a less lethal alternative to a gun. Now it's a more dangerous alternative to a hand. That kind of thing. Anyway, so now we got to take this break, but we'll be right back in just a second with Michael Wartofsky. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 25th in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. It's just $15. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. All right, guys, welcome back. So we are talking about the police state with Michael Alexander Gould Wartofsky. The Homeland Security state, well, never really did have a bunch of Al-Qaeda running around, so let's just target the hippies or whoever else wants to be so uppity as to think they can protest in the street against what their government is doing to them. And so Michael Alexander Gould Wartofsky, he's really broken it down here at TomDispatch.com and at Antiwar.com under Tom Engelhardt's name there at Antiwar.com. He's really broken down a lot of how this is working, as we can already see, and how it's getting much worse. Can you talk, tell us about the LRADs, the sound cannons? Now, those are for persecuting Iraqis with, right?
Yeah, that was their original intention, and was designed for military use. It's what's called the sound cannon in colloquial terms, a long-range acoustic device, and it concentrates and directs acoustic energy at its targets at up to 152 decibels, something that's really acknowledged by the police themselves as unsafe for human ears. This has been deployed in recent years. It was originally deployed only to communicate police orders. That was supposed to be the only use of it. We saw it in New York City in 2004, again in 2011, as I document in my book on the eviction of the Occupy Wall Street occupiers from Zuccotti Park. But we really haven't seen its sound deterrent feature in action until recent months, when it was deployed as a quote-unquote area denial device against protesters in Ferguson and Manhattan.
Area denial device. That's nice.
It is nice, yeah.
Yeah, give that a nice little set of initials and move on, and it doesn't really matter.
Right.
And of course, I love
that's
this. Right. Well, we gave him a howitzer, but we told him just bang it with a wrench as a bell, as a warning, but don't ever shoot anybody with it. You know?
Right.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah, give it 10 years, right? And here we are today.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah. It took that long. Is that really the first use of it, or did they do this back at the 2008 conventions and that kind of thing? I forget now.
They tried to use it very, very briefly in Pittsburgh at the G8 protest there, but there was a lot of controversy, so they backed off. But it's now in active use, and its use has been really seen all over the country in these recent protests.
Yeah, we're used to it now. It's like mom and apple pie. That's
yep,
the American
yep,
way we shoot protesters with sound cannons. Because, hey, why not?
That's right. And that's
it's
the
like
thing,
Bill
if you
Hicks.
Have this weapon.
It's right. Like Bill Hicks talking about they got a big weapons catalog open. What's this one do, Tommy? They're just playing, basically. You know?
That's right. These are so many toys to them.
Yeah. And so what does that make us? You know, that's the thing. All right,
yep.
Now, so what's the skunk? Tell me about that.
So this is what's known as a stink bomb. Some of us might be familiar with the more harmless renditions of this from our childhood, but this is really something used to mark protesters by smell, right? And it's described by some people who've experienced it as a combination of quote unquote dead animal and human excrement. It's something that law enforcement can shoot at a target. And just knock them down and then mark them so that they can know later who they were shooting at once the crowd disperses. So, you know, there's no way you can get that off of you once you've been shot with it. And they're eagerly stockpiling this stuff all across the country, starting out in Ferguson. So this is the latest in the sort of less lethal warfare. And this particular one is a war on our senses.
Yeah. Well, and... I don't know. It's just an example of, hey, what won't they do, right? Whatever they can think of to go ahead and implement that's, you know, at least somewhat within the budget, go ahead, you know?
That's right.
All right. So, now this is where we get into the real Orwellian part. It's number four on your list here, Michael. Replace humans with robots and predictive technology. In other words, outsource all the decision making to inanimate objects.
That's right. And you know, they've been working on this for a while. It's not fully autonomous yet, but they have these remotely piloted aircraft, as we know, conventionally known as drones, vehicles, land vehicles, and other robotic platforms that are now being deployed on the ground and in the air to surveil our protest activity and also to connect to other sort of surveillance detection systems. So this is now being sort of perfectly integrated with all the other technologies that they have at their hands. And this is in use. Drones are now in use by at least 19 police and sheriff's departments, as well as National Guard in 9 states or more for this purpose. So this is something that's the new frontier, at the new frontier of protest policing. There's also something known as predictive policing, or PredPol, which sort of calculates where they think a crime is going to be committed, where the big data tells you it's most likely to be committed, and when, and who might be responsible. So this is some next level stuff here.
Well, and the thing is, too, is it'd be impossible probably to argue that it's worthless, although as long as it's a government program, hopefully none of it will be too effective. But in theory, you know, identifying the most often arrested people in a neighborhood, I'm trying to remember, I think it was in Los Angeles or, you know, part of Los Angeles where they were doing this, and it was actually working pretty well, and they were able to, the computer was able to see patterns in behavior that the cops, you know, by themselves wouldn't have picked up on and that kind of thing. And so as long as it's just a little bit useful, you know, if they can even guess that maybe one time it'll help them save a kidnapped child or something like that, then how could anybody resist? It just, again, as long as it can be implemented, it will be implemented.
It will be implemented. That's right. The thing is, it's not being implemented to rescue kidnapped children from what we know. I mean, it has been deployed, you know, to sort of great fanfare by departments like the LAPD and now the NYPD, which is working with Microsoft to implement this across the domain with the domain awareness system. But we're really talking about following us in real time at all times and trying to give intelligence analysts what they call, quote, a comprehensive view of potential threats. So we're not talking about people who have already committed crimes or who are likely to kidnap children. We're talking about those people who are identified by the state as potential threats to them.
Right. Yeah, now, and I guess we're at the point where, as you mentioned, the cops are using drones somewhat. Are there any American cities where the cops just unapologetically fly drones over the city all day long, kind of watching that kind of thing yet?
Yes. So Los Angeles is one of those cities. They have 2 Dragonflyer X6 drones for use. They admit that they use these during protests. There was quite a few eyewitness reports of police helicopters and drones kind of working in tandem in Baltimore. And then there was an attempted implementation of this in Seattle as well, but Seattle pushed back. The people in Seattle pushed back, and the local government was forced to sell those drones down to the LAPD and get rid of them. So it is possible to resist this this kind of latest offensive, robotic offensive, if you will, but I think it's going to take a lot more than what we've seen to stop it.
Yeah, I was noticing a thing that I guess it was Glenn Greenwald wrote about how they've worked very hard to coin this phrase bulk collection because it sounds not necessarily softer, I guess, but just nice and besides the point from calling it mass surveillance, which is, you know, as you put it there, which is what this is. Predictive policing doesn't work unless they're collecting on all of us. And so now it's just a question of, you know, how many extra drones does the Pentagon have, and how soon can they, you know, get Reapers and Predators up in the air over L.A. and the rest of America's major cities. Seems like, you know, with the cameras and the rest of this stuff, it's just a matter of time.
It is, and I think I wouldn't be surprised if they developed a 1033 program for drone technology at some point.
Right. And now, so what was the thing about Minnesota and the mall and the joint task force here and make friends and follow people?
So this is something. This is also the sort of new generation of protest policing, where it's not just the conventional police forces, the uniformed police that we're talking about, or even plainclothes police. We're talking about private security units that are working together with national intelligence agencies and other law enforcement. And in this case, we saw the Mall of America has its own sort of counterterrorism unit called the Risk Assessment and Mitigation Unit. And they were caught. This was some great investigative work that was done by The Intercept. They were caught building fake Facebook accounts and building dossiers on 10 or more local activists who were planning a peaceful protest at the Mall of America. And they worked together with the Joint Terrorism Task Force, which is anchored by the FBI, worked together with them to follow these people and track these people ahead of the protest, and then used that information once people had been arrested for protesting on Mall of America property to pursue charges against these people. And it turned out that the Mall of America's legal unit was coordinating with the local government and with law enforcement to press these charges. So this is again sort of make friends and follow people is one way of putting it. But this is really the new age of media, social media surveillance, and we need to be aware of these things when we're on these social media sites.
Yeah, well, and you know, it's funny because when you put it that way, especially the Mall of America thing, it's such a perfect example of the empire coming home here, where as long as we have a terror war, it's such an obvious target. Of course, you know, they have this thing to protect from lone wolf, ISIS-inspired wackos or whatever. And then, of course, if somebody's going to have a protest, they're going to go ahead. They're going to conflate the two adversaries in their eyes so that they can use the powers for one in the name of the other. And that kind of thing, the same story's being told all over America. You know, the whole country's one big Mall of America anyway.
That's right.
You know, that's... It's just people got to recognize as long as we keep making enemies overseas, our government is going to keep these excuses for these kind of clampdowns on the rest of us. But
that's right. And we can recall George W. Bush's words shortly after 9/11, you know, everyone should go shopping, but make sure that's the only thing you're doing, right, in this Mall of America.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, because they're watching you real close, right? Like, I'm reminded, yeah. I'm not sure, but I would be willing to bet that they went and got, you know, Las Vegas casino security to give them advice how to lock that thing down. They're smart.
That's right.
All right. Hey, thanks for coming on the show. Great interview. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, Scott.
All right, y'all. That is Michael Alexander Gould Wartofsky. And he is the author of the new book. Sorry, I didn't say this at the beginning. He's the author of the new book, The Occupiers, The Making of the 99% Movement. And that's it. We're over time. We've got to go. Bye.